Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We all know that racism in some form or another exists in America. We may have experienced it, but for many people of color, we're not privy to the private racist conversations that happen when we are not around. Well, tonight, we're getting that. Matt and Tawny Browning are the co-authors of a new book, The Hate Next Door, Undercover Within the New Face of White Supremacy. As you may have guessed, they are not people of color, and they join us with a very unique look at this long-standing issue. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Matt, Tawny, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
We feel blessed to be here.
So I'll start with you, Tawny. Why write this book?
You know, it kind of started out as therapy. I wanted Matt to get some of these stories and the traumas and the things that happened out of his head. And the best way to do that was to get it on paper.
Mm-hmm. What happened, Matt? How did you... You were in law enforcement.
Right.
And that was really kind of the impetus for this. Give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of how you went undercover.
Well, it's real easy. I was on a squad working gangs, and we worked predominantly Hispanic gangs. So I was the only white guy, and I couldn't do undercover work like the rest of the guys on my squad could do. Yeah, and so they would go.
Why is that?
I didn't fit in a Tejano bar or anywhere else. So I got stuck in the van watching, writing down license plates, calling off, you know, when the players would show up. And I got tired of it. But what really did it for me was one night I was on my way home from working a gang case out of Phoenix. And I stopped to help a motor officer. And sure enough, he tried to stop a skinhead. Mm-hmm. And the skinhead tried to kill me. So that made me think, if he tried to kill me as a police officer, who else is he going to go after? So I started diving into the ideologies of white supremacy and specifically your street-level skinheads.
Was this a hard sell for your superiors?
Yeah. Yeah, because some of the guys I worked with, I mean, you got to look at it. When I started it, it was white supremacy was not... I grew up in Phoenix. I never knew there was white supremacy. I didn't know that we had war skins and the Klan and National Alliance and all these other groups around. And so to try to get your supervisors to buy off on, okay, let's go about and do this, was like, no, we need to see what's going on. We need to understand, in order for you to work undercover, there's got to be some type of crimes that are occurring for us to go after these guys.
I was about to say, because as terrible as it sounds, being racist is not illegal.
It's not illegal. What's illegal is once you go past the ideologies into action, once you commit the violence, anybody can think and say whatever they want. I mean, we can do that in this country. It's what you do with your thoughts. It's what you do with the ideology that you're learning. Is then when you act out in violence, it becomes a crime, and that's when we jumped in.
When you started this, were you able to talk to your wife about what you were about to do, or did you have to keep this close to the vest?
No, I told Tawny everything.
And what was your reaction?
No, he kept a lot of it close to the vest. But when it started to, it was a whole new ideology, a whole new way of thinking, and I could see that it was affecting him. So I did kind of pull some of those stories and thoughts I helped you talk. Because it wasn't something easy for him to even try to process or unpack. It was so far removed from anything decent.
You got to look at it like this, is that, you know, a lot of people think it's undercover work as, you know, I'm going to go buy a 20 rock, or I'm going to go buy some stolen cars, or I'm going to buy, it's usually drugs, firearms, cars is what you're buying. This isn't, when you're working white supremacy, that's not what it is. It's an ideology that you're taking your brain into. And in order to understand, you have to start studying and learning what the ideology of hate is. And studies have shown is that hate, constant hate on your brain, it reworks the fibers in your brain, causes new highways to go in. And I had to talk, and that's why I was lucky to have Tani was pulled this stuff out of my head.
When did you start to see that it started affecting him?
Well, he didn't just work undercover in white supremacy, so he was working all kinds of different things. So he would work at a gay sex club, white supremacists hate gay men. Mm-hmm. So that was it was just starting to affect his mind. So it wasn't too long into it. Well, I just remember one particular time that he stopped going to church. Mm. And he was always doing undercover gigs on Sunday. And I just finally sat down and said, look, dude, we have 5 kids. They need their dad. And I didn't get married to go to church alone.
Mm. How about that? 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to the co-authors of The Hate Next Door, Undercover Within the New Face of White Supremacy. If you have a comment or a question, we invite you to give us a call. So, Matt, as I said, it is not against the law to be racist or prejudiced or anything like that. What were you looking for when you went undercover, and what did that look like? What did being undercover look like for you?
It looked like Doc Martens with red laces, braced up, shaved heads, tattoos, swastikas, white power, white pride, all the things that you would know that white supremacy was tattooed on these guys. So my job was to get into the intelligence side, gather who they are, what's going on. We know that they are out committing crimes. There was a Filiberto's in Mesa that they would go to, and they would beat up the minorities that were buying their food at Filiberto's one night. And so we know they're committing crime. We knew that they were out doing hunting trips. Now, what a hunting trip is when they all pile into one car and they'll drive around through minority neighborhoods throughout Phoenix, and then they'll see some minorities and they'll jump out and beat the living crap out of guys. And it's been rumored that they've actually killed some guys, and they leave on the side of the road, they get back in their car, and they go and do it again. And so we knew this stuff was going on, but we had to find out exactly who was involved in it. And so from my undercover work, we had 19 of these guys were locked up for murder or attempted murder. And so my undercover work, I think, was kind of successful.
When you were, did you witness some of these things as well?
No, you can't. As a police officer, you can't do. Take law enforcement out of it. As a person, I could not stand and watch somebody get beat, get shot, get stabbed. I would have to jump in. And so we had a murder in Phoenix where they beat a guy to death, and it was called a boot party. A guy walks out. These skinheads were kicked out of a pool hall. They punched a kid in the face. He fell down, and that's when the boot party started, and they started kicking him with their steel-toed boots. And the guy drug himself through the parking lot until he eventually died from the trauma. I was supposed to be there at the bar that night. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to be there, but it was our anniversary, and it was one of those times when, you know what, I'm going to spend some time with my wife, and that was the night that Cole Bailey was murdered.
There's some deep regret and guilt over that, because I really believe that Matt would have stopped that had he been there, and he probably could have stopped it before it even started.
But that at that point would have blown your cover.
Here's something we need to understand, and I think we learned this later on in the work that Tani and I did together, is that not everybody has to go to jail. If we stop things from happening, and we put out that we stop things from happening, these organizations will disband, because now they're worried that they're going to go to jail, or they're worried that they're going to be outed as a racist. And I think we need to do that more together as a community, is just start, you know, identifying, seeing, outing people for who they are. And I'm not promoting going out and outing all this, but I'm saying if we know this crew, this group is involved in white supremacy, and they're involved in hunting trips and beatings and things like that, then we need to do something about it, and we need to expose them for what they are. And just like when you shine a flashlight on a roach, it runs away. And that's what happens in these situations.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking to the co-authors of The Hate Next Door, Undercover Within the New Face of White Supremacy. Lisa, calling from Gaithersburg. Lisa, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Hi.
Hi.
Earlier they said the work was affecting him. Could you be more specific and tell us how was it affecting you, and how did you address it?
Well, I can speak for myself, and this is, it's a hard thing to talk about because as a police officer, we don't like to admit the fact that we struggle and we hurt with the traumas of the job. So for me, it's like I would go to a Klan rally or a Klan meeting, and then I would leave with the ideology that I was taught at that meeting to hate minorities, whether they're, you know, the Mexicans, the blacks, the Jews, whatever it might be at that meeting. And then that ideology would then mix with the way that I was raised and how I was brought up to be against everything that now I'm sitting and listening to. And it causes, you just start questioning everything in life. You start questioning who you are. You start questioning what I'm doing. And if I was lucky, because Tawny was able to get me back to reality of saying, you know, Matt, these are our kids. We live in this home. We are safe. Everything's good. Look, our neighbors are good people. The people we associate are good people. Not everybody is a hater. Not everybody is out to get, you know, who it is. Then, you know, then trauma causes nightmares. Trauma causes anger and outbursts and all kinds of different things.
How did all of that impact your marriage and you as specifically, you know, as a wife? I get the impression that you didn't marry a racist, but now he was having this kind of pressure on him.
I know that Matt is such a good man. I married a good man. And so when I would say to him, if not you, who? Mm. And I meant that, because I knew he was a good man, and I knew that he wanted to do right, and his intentions were pure, and I knew he could make a difference.
Yeah.
And so my job was to support him.
Was it hard?
Yes, it was hard. I mean, for the most part, it was okay. I want to support him in what he's doing, but there was times where we needed him. He was our protector. We needed him at home, and you know, he was out there doing what he did.
Lisa, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about The Hate Next Door, Undercover Within, The New Face of White Supremacy, co-authors in the studio. We're going to take a break, but don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com, or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you want to give us a call, lines are open right now at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. We'll be back with this conversation in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Matt and Tawny Browning are the co-authors of a new book, The Hate Next Door, Undercover Within the New Face of White Supremacy. Lines are open if you have a comment or question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Now, Matt, you said that this investigation was in the Phoenix area, but did you get any impression as to how widespread and entrenched the white supremacists were in everyday life?
Yeah, you know, white supremacy has no borders. If you go with your typical, you know, your old school gangs, they have different boundaries. They don't go past different neighborhoods, different streets. White supremacy, there is none of that. So what I found is I was associating with people from Idaho, from Washington, from the East Coast, from the West Coast, from all over the place. It got to the point where Tawny and I were investigating people out of the UK that were coming over. We were investigating people out of Australia and that were coming to the US, and we were giving Australia information for the people from the US going to Australia. So when you look at the groups like your Warskins or your Hammerskins or your, you know, your National Alliance, your Boot Boys, whatever, put whatever name on, they all associate with each other. And this is, you know, talking on the cell phone. They all know who each other is. And now with the internet and you're able to talk to anybody in the world at any time, hate travels. It's the same ideology as in the U.S. as in the U.K. We hate. They hate. They want to hate. They want to inflict violence on people who are not like them. And they will take that violence and promote it in anywhere that anybody will listen to them.
Do you, in the conversations that you were either having with them or conversations that you may have overheard, where does this hate come from? Why does it happen?
You know what? That's a great question, because you're not born with the ability to hate. Mm-hmm. Nobody is born in this world to hate. Hate is taught. And so whether it comes from a family member or from an uncle or a friend, hate is a learned thing that changes your mind. Now, if you go back, we would go and make leaflets and flyers and distribute them in the neighborhoods. And, you know, I would always say, you know, let's go to South Phoenix. Let's distribute flyers in South Phoenix.
But what's in South Phoenix?
See, now South Phoenix is a rough neighborhood. That's where all your Hispanic and black gangs are at.
Okay.
And so I'm thinking, hey, let's see what these guys are about if we go to this neighborhood. They're scared to death to go there. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go there. They want to go to neighborhoods that are predominantly upscale white neighborhoods that if we throw out 1,500 flyers, one phone call back to us as a recruit is a success. And so, you know, it hate is learned through music. It is learned through speeches that they hear. And you know what's crazy is now hate is learned by just watching the news.
What do you mean by that?
There's so much division in this country right now. Mm-hmm. Nobody is getting along. Everybody is yelling at each other. There's no examples of what true leadership looks like or is, because there's no more middle ground. There's extremes everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we need to come back together. And that's one of the reasons why we wrote The Hate Next Door, is because we want people to read it and start the conversations. To have that conversation with your neighbor, have a conversation with your senator, have a conversation with whoever it is, so we can get rid of this hate, we can get rid of the ideology, and we can get back to, man, let's make this place a great place.
Tawny, Americans.
Tawny, what is sin?
Sin started out as the Skinhead Intelligence Network, and it is now, we've changed it to the Supremacists Intelligence Network. And Matt kind of started that with that name. I'll let you tell why you started with Sin.
Well, back when we started Sin, all the bikers, man, everybody wanted to investigate the biker gangs. Everybody wanted to the OMGs were the place to be. And so in Arizona, their organization was called AMEN, for Arizona Motorcycle Enforcement Mission. And it's like, okay, well, what can I do to show these guys that we got something going on too? Well, amen is like saying a prayer, so I'm going to say sin. You know, we'll be against you guys.
I get it.
So that's why we came up with sin.
Amen. Yeah.
And so, but we brought it together because I found, working undercover, I didn't know if Phoenix PD had somebody in my organization, if Glendale, if there's another Mesa cop or FBI had people within this group I was undercover with. There was no communication. So Sin started so officers and cops could communicate with each other and we could solve the problems. If Mesa doesn't talk to Phoenix, nothing's going to get solved. We border each other nearly. If we don't talk, we're not going to solve anything. And so Sin was started as a communication tool for law enforcement.
How long did this go on? I mean, your undercover work.
13 plus years.
You know, as a fan of police dramas, one of the things that we, you know, often know, and I've also covered cops and courts in my career, is that at any given time, your cover can be blown.
Mm-hmm.
A small mistake can do that. And what you're talking about now is in investigating white supremacy. Were you concerned, and did you find that there were sympathizers or people who were involved from other police departments or other law enforcement agencies during the course of your investigation?
Simple answer, yes.
How did you address that, and was it addressed as far as legal case, prosecution, and the like?
I think once you cross that line, when you're a police officer, you're a police officer. But as soon as you cross that line to go hang out with the whatever organization you want to hang out with, you now become just like them. So I don't care if you're a cop at all. You're part of that organization. And if you're hanging out, then I'll go after you just like them. And so what we did, and luckily my biggest fear in working undercover, especially in the white supremacy groups, was not being burned by a skinhead or a member of a militia or anything else. It was always the fear of being burned by a fellow cop. And so when I did see one, I would kind of back off, shy away from it a little bit, and then I contact that agency and let them know.
How did you exit this process?
Which process?
Well, being undercover in this case. I mean, did this go on until you retired, or was there a point where you just left, or how did that work? You're giving Tawny one of those looks.
Matt was asked by the Arizona legislature to come talk at the Capitol about how hate was fueling the border issues.
Mm.
And what we had understood was that would be a closed session for just the legislatures.
Yeah, and it wasn't. The guy that was the head of the National Alliance at the time that I was like in that organization, and the guy who was part of every hate group around at that time, they both showed up at the meeting, and I was outed. You know, I went my whole career without a complaint. I woke up the next morning with, you know, in the teens number of complaints against me.
I think there was 19.
Yeah. And so my chief pulled me off the street, stuck me in an office, and said, "You're done."
Were you worried about your safety at that point?
I was worried about, yes, yeah. Yeah, because then, and that's when Tawny really started getting involved, because the guy who showed up, his name was JT Reddy. He's since killed himself after he killed a family of four. JT, he said that, you know, Matt Browning should be buried out in the desert. And that started the whole thing going of death threats and things like that coming in. So that's what Tawny loves to study. And she will study something into the ground at times. And she said, "I need to learn who these people are. If they're going to threaten you or our family, then I need to know who they are."
And I knew as a woman, I could get into their hearts and minds in a way that a man might not be able to do.
Tawny, let me ask you this. How did, whether it was the revelation after Matt's testimony or during this process, how did this affect your relationship with your girlfriends and the like? What kind of conversations did you have? Did you try to talk about this issue quietly, slowly, or did you have any incidents with girlfriends when, you know, they said something that made you clutch your pearls, or what?
You know, when this went down, this is one reason that we wrote the book, The Hate Next Door, is because it was all around us. And I couldn't believe that my girlfriends and my family and the people around me did not see now what my eyes had been open to. So there, when he was talking about being outed, there was a great big meeting. And I wanted to go. And one of my girlfriends went with me. And she kind of helped me spread some of this word, but it was so wild, such a crazy train for me, because I was living in this world and I knew this world existed.
Give me an example of was something that surprised you.
Well, we had a politician in Arizona, a senator, and he was a hater. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he was associating with these guys and things like that. And I couldn't believe that, okay, these are supposed to be my people, and I don't want anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. So.
But there was also times like our kids had a 4-H lamb. And so our son had a project where he takes a lamb and builds it, you know, feeds it, and then they go and sell it, you know, make some money to buy
county fairs, the whole thing.
Exactly. Well, the day after Christmas, on December 26th, one of our sons woke up and the lamb was murdered and thrown on our back patio.
Oh, God.
And so that's why when it's called The Hate Next Door, you know, it's really next door. It's at our homes. And Tawny, it was that incident there when she started talking to her friends, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the friends were saying, "Oh, come on now."
Oh, I got that so much. I got, "Oh, come on now. This isn't happening." And it is, and it was. And it didn't just show up on our back porch, but it showed up at the dinner table. my sister was dating a guy who had 88 right here on his arm.
Yeah, and for those who are not familiar with 88, I know it's a World War II Nazi symbol, but explain to them what the 88 is.
Yeah, 88 is the eighth letter of the alphabet is H, so 88 would be Heil Hitler.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Marcus calling from D.C. Thanks for hanging on, Marcus. What's on your mind? Marcus, are you there? Marcus, give me a call back. Let me go to Theodore calling from Boston. Theodore, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. I was simply wondering if there's a new face of hate or white supremacy, what would be the differentiation between, I guess, the tattoos, the swastikas, the legacy or the lineage of KKK and things of that nature? Is it more hidden? Is it more subversive? Is it more opaque as opposed to right in front of you? Is it covert is what I'm trying to say.
You know, that's a great question. And the best way to answer that is this way. White supremacy used to look like boots and braces. Doc Martin boots, red laces, and your braces, your suspenders. That is almost a thing of the past. You still see it around. But now what it is khakis and camos. And so you have your organizations now, and I don't want to give them any breath of wind to mention their names, but they're going to be wearing the khakis. They're going to be wearing polo shirts. They're going to be dressed up, trying to be all militaristic while they're marching around, but they all have the matching, you know, khaki pants and the white polo shirt.
Preppy.
Preppy look.
Preppy racist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they look like. Then you're going to have your guys that wear the camouflage and the Hawaiian suits, their Hawaiian shirts with their ARs and different things like that. And so the face of hate has definitely changed from, you know, a tattoo of an 88 on your forehead or a skin on your forehead to now all that's getting covered up because they were having a hard time recruiting people when they look like thugs. They want to be more into the colleges. They want to be more into the, you know, the schools. They're getting out of the hate music, but once you get in the organization, you're going to be listening to the hate music. That's one of the biggest ideology bound things around is the hate music. But yeah, it's now covering up the tattoos, going with the khakis and camos. You'll see a subtle bumper sticker or a subtle T-shirt.
What's a bumper sticker that the average person may see but may not recognize as a message of hate?
We were actually watching TV last night. I won't say the name of the commercial all, but anyways, on the bottom it had a code to use to order a certain object, and it was 88 was the code.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing the person who's the far right, you know, probably a supporter in some of this in one way or another, but it's just little tiny subtle hints, like an 88, a 14, a little sticker with a 14, which represents the 14 words by David Lane. Mm-hmm. And they're the little iron cross with some runic writing around it. Just little tiny subtle hints that aren't your swastika in your face type thing anymore.
Theodore, thank you so much for your question. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Jermaine calling from Baltimore. Jermaine, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to say first thank you to the officer and to his wife for offering their story. I can imagine that their families possibly have been targeted and threatened. So I will be the first as a black gay man to say thank you for this work that you are doing. A comment that I could offer, just going forward, if you sit on a board, whether it's a board of church or the PTO for any children or schools, if you get a chance to look around, especially if you service a community that is diverse and all you see is people who look like you, that's a step further to offer the conversation of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Again, just thoughts. And it feels like you all already are doing that. But I just definitely wanted to say thank you for offering your story.
Oh, thank you.
Jermaine, thank you so much. Now, it's also my understanding, you know, Tawny, that you did
participate in some undercover work in some way, shape, or form?
Well, some of it started because Matt was so passionate about the work that it was always in his mind, and he sometimes I needed him with me. So I would say, okay, so if we go and get this information, can we go out to dinner or do something that I want to do? Mm-hmm. So some of that started just as simply as that. So we would go to concerts and things like that, and I found out that I was really good at getting information.
What kind of information?
Well, just, okay, there's going to be a party here. This kind of thing is going on here. We have these people showing up here. And so then I didn't even know that it was really important. And then I would tell Matt, and he's like, I've been trying to find that out for weeks. That kind of thing.
You know, Matt, in my head, I make an assumption when you are doing this undercover work that you are only talking about men, but I'm assuming that's not the case.
No, they're called skin birds.
And skin birds.
Birds. They're called birds. The females in the group are birds, and sometimes they're more violent than the guys are. Matter of fact, when Cole Bailey Jr. was murdered, the boot party that I told you about, that started with some of the birds fighting another girl for looking at the skinhead guys inside this pool hall. And it started with these skin chicks. And so they're just as active and just as violent and mean and horrible as the guys are.
Had you had any interaction with these skin birds or skin bird type?
There was one that, you know, was a friend of mine that I was, but most of the girls didn't love me. It was the boys that I had more success in getting the information from.
That's amazing.
And they would say to me things like, you know, even warriors need a soft place to land. And so I'm like, tell me your information, you know, basically.
Has this experience changed you to as individuals and as a married couple at all?
Do you want to start or you want me
That's
to?
That's an excellent question. I don't know how we could have our eyes open to the hate next door that's right around us and not be changed.
How do you think it has changed your outlook on whatever?
Well, I mean, I grew up in I would say at least 30% of my classes growing up in grade school were Hispanic. So mm-hmm. I had no idea. I mean, I knew that there was racism with black, but that it went so deeply of people of color, I just had no idea. And it was shocking to me. Mm-hmm. And once I knew something, I knew we had to do something.
What about you? How did it change you, man?
Well, what I found, it changed me in a lot of different ways. I mean, of course, because of the traumas and all this stuff, it changed me that luckily I had Tani and the kids at home that could help me out there. What I learned, two very important lessons. Number one is that there is zero communication within law enforcement. We don't talk to each other. We'll go to a gang conference, but we don't spend the time talking about what's going on in our jurisdictions so we can work together to actually solve a problem. That was number one. Number two, a lot of the ideology and rhetoric that is used in white power movement or in the nationalist movement or in the hate movement is bogus.
What do you mean by that?
It's not truth. It's made up. It is at one time a fact that has been twisted and turned 14 times to where there's no way that there's truth in it. You know, you go back to the Christian identity movement, which was, you know, that Eve slept with Satan and then the black race started. It's not truth. There's no truth there.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, there's no truth in the way that a white supremacist would look at anybody other than a white person. There's just no truth because nobody takes the time to talk. And I think that's really, for me, one of the main reasons why we wrote The Hate Next Door. Read it and let's talk about it. If you have a problem with me, and the way that I've handled hits on me is that I find out I have a hit on me, then I will go and talk to the person. I said, I'm right here. What do you want to do? And we'll talk. And we'll have a conversation. And they understand I'm doing my job. You broke the law. You have to take the consequences for that. But I'm doing my job and what I'm doing.
When you say a hit, you're talking about a threat against your life?
Yeah, I've had like 9 of them.
I can't imagine how you as a wife deals with that.
You know, he was always our protector. So I knew that my job was to make sure that the home was safe. I mean, I know this sounds so traditional, but, you know, I knew that was my job. And that's what I tried to do, create almost a Disney-esque type home, which is not sustainable. And I knew that when my 6-year-old was sleeping with a knife under his pillow. so that he could protect me when his dad wasn't home. So it was seeping into the home no matter what.
And we started out this whole journey in my undercover work, and I told Tawny, we had an agreement. Tawny, if I tell you to leave, then you need to leave. You need to take the kids. You need to go. I need to deal with something. Because my undercover persona, I wasn't married. I had no girlfriend. I had no kids. I had a landscaping company, and that was it. And so the Klan comes and confronts me in a Walmart while we're out shopping with the family. And so I say, Tawny, you need to go. And so Tawny took the kids and go.
I did not. I looked at him. I'm like, why? I don't want to go. We're out together.
But she ended up going, or I ended up turning around and walking away. But the next time that happened, the mindset between Tawny and I changed. And Tawny was like, no, I'm sticking around watching this one. The kids aren't here. I can be here part of this with you, and we can take care of this together. And so what this journey has done is, I think, is first of all, writing the book was a struggle all in itself. And I think that has brought us closer together. I think I understand Tawny's, man, the stuff that she did for me during my career is, we could sit here for hours and talk about, and how she would bring me back to reality, and how we would clear the hate out of my mind, and all kinds of stuff. But the journey is communication.
Mm-hmm.
We got to talk.
You said your youngest is now 17. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And you have 5 children, and they are in various and sundry stages of professional careers and the like. What impact has this work and the book had on your children? I mean, I'm sure, short of having the 6-year-old with the knife under the pillow, which is heartbreaking in and of itself, but as they become adults and close to adults, what kind of conversations have you had with them about this?
Well, when they were in high school, we'd have parties and things, and we were such a diverse. I was so grateful that my children were making friends with people that they liked, and we had a diverse group. I think they learned to definitely do that.
I think it was harder because our kids didn't really know what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They knew dad was a cop and that dad was an undercover cop, but I don't think they really understood what I was doing. And then I don't think they really understood what their mom was doing when she would disappear with me and go to a show or whatever else, or she's talking on the phone, whatever it might be. But then when they read the book, and we've heard it from probably all of them now, it's like, I get it now.
So that's what was happening.
I see.
Have you all had conversations with them besides, just saying, this is what was happening then and this was happening then, but about the philosophy and the understanding about racism and what you discovered?
I think we've had plenty of talks with our kids saying that we love everybody.
Mm.
There's no hate in this home. We will not have hate in this home. We love the company of other people. We love learning different
about each other.
Yeah.
Bring the best you have. We'll bring the best we have. And we can, it's just so trite. I know it is. I've stopped saying it. I think love wins. I really do. I think that love wins, which means knowing that people care about you, that you have space, that you have a home, that you have the freedom to speak. It's, love does win.
Have you spoken to police departments about your work post retirement, and have they been receptive at all to hearing from you?
Well, I was just 2 days ago, I was teaching at a seminar in Chandler, Arizona, on white supremacy. I go around and teach, we go around and teach all over the place about white supremacy. But what we came to D.C. for was the mental health side of law enforcement, to speak with some people about mental health and how we can help police officers with mental health issues.
Tell me about that. That's important. That's a thing.
That's the thing. I'm a firm believer is that when you become a police officer, you really have the desire to help. You really do. You want to change the community that you're working in. And I think that as you go through your career and the traumas that you get is what's causing your brain to do what it does, and it changes the person as a police officer. I think if we don't take care of our mental health and law enforcement, we've already had, I believe, 50 officers commit suicide this year alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the numbers are just going to increase. We're not robots. I'm not a robot. I'm lucky. I'm I will say it every day, all day. I'm sitting here today because of Tawny and my kids. Mm-hmm. And I was able to, Tawny talked me off more ledges than I want to even talk about. And I think we need to get our faces out of the bottle and get back into communicating with professional help. But we need to have our departments, our chiefs of police, our sheriffs, our legislators, our people in politics. Everybody needs to get on board with this, you know?
Okay. If we're identifying a problem, if communities are having a problem with their police, with law enforcement, then we need to offer a solution as well. And there are solutions.
There is one thing I wanted to ask you, going back to, you know, the issue regarding this book. The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, certainly I was here.
Right.
And this is my home. And so it was certainly, from a news perspective, it was fascinating. But from a native's perspective, a native Washingtonian, it was terrifying. It was something that angered me. Are these the people that you were talking about? And from your perspective, where in the hierarchy of organized racist organizations does the Proud Boys fall?
Well, the Proud Boys is an interesting, I'll say, phenomenon, because I don't think the Proud Boys can last. But I think the Proud Boys, what they are, they're a bunch of, all they want to do is fight. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's their mentality. They want to fight. Their leader was Puerto Rican or Cuban, so he wasn't a white guy. But within the Proud Boy community, within the Proud Boy organization, you have your haters. And I know specifically of guys from Arizona that were part of Skinhead Crews that are Proud Boys. And you have that and you mix that in. And so now you take the wantingness to fight to going and standing outside libraries, throwing up Sig Heils while somebody is reading a book inside, or going to school board meetings to supposedly protect the school board because they're changing it while throwing up Sig Heils. But the Proud Boys is just a little piece of that puzzle, that January 6th puzzle, because you have Oath Keepers who predominantly are law enforcement and ex-military that were part of it. You also had your 3%ers, which are prominently, you know, military or patriot organizations that were part of it. And as you go through, and if you look at the different pictures from January 6th, you'll see swastikas, you'll see different tattoos of different organizations, different T-shirts, different signifiers that I can tell, hate was present. Hate was there.
Real quick, what do you want people to take away from this book?
You need to open up your eyes and see that hate is all around us, and that we can all take a, we can all do something, and it does start with us.
This was a lot. Matt and Tawny Browning, thank you so much for coming to D.C. and working on mental health for law enforcement officers. But thank you also for writing this book. And we hope that it does open the eyes of everyone, not just not white folks, but black folks as well. And everybody, as a matter of fact. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, July 27th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.